the Irish priests followed St. Columba, who himself was a great-grandson of Conall Gulban, who, tradition states, had fierce battles with a race of dwarfs. Conall Gulban's fights with the dwarfs, indeed, are the origin of a series of tales sometimes attributed to other legendary heroes. If we try to get as close as possible to the original story, this is what we get. Conall Gulban was the son of the famous Niall, or Niall, the ancestor of the O'Neills of Ulster. He was the paternal grandfather of Fedd Limmick, the father of St. Columba, and his adventures begin in the northwest of Ireland, somewhere in the dawn of the 5th century. After various experiences, Gulban landed in the realm of Lochlann, generally believed to be Scandinavia, which itself had a rather vague meaning at the time. The Gulban was intrigued by a strange construction and asked his guide, "What pointed house is there, Dúnadh?" "That is the house of the Tamhéisg, the best warriors that are in the realm of Lochlann, Dúnadh," the guide replied. "I heard my grandfather speaking about the Tamhéisg," said Conall, "but I have never seen them. I will go to see them. It were not my counsel to thee," were Dúnadh's last words. This advice, naturally, Conall Gulban disregarded. He went straight to the palace of the King of Lochlann and challenged him to combat. He was told that he should get no fighting at that time of night, but he should get lodging in the house of the Muskwisks, where there were 1,800 musk, and 80 score. He went, and he went in, and there were none of the Muish within that did not grin. When he saw that they had made a grin, he himself made two. "What was the meaning of your grinning at us?" said the Musk. "What was the meaning of your grinning at me?" said Conall. Said they, "Our grinning at thee meant that thy fresh royal blood will be ours to quench our thirst, and thy fresh royal flesh to polish our teeth." "And," said Conall, "the meaning of my grinning is, that I will look out for the one with the biggest knob and slenderest shanks, and knock out the brains of the rest with that one, and his brains with the knobs of the rest." At this point, each of the Uisks put a stake of wood against the door, and Conall asked them why they had done so. "We have never seen coming here, one, a gulp of whose blood, or a morsel of whose flesh could reach us, but thou thyself, except one other man, and he fled from us. And now everyone is doubting the other in case thou shouldest flee. That was the thing that made me do it myself likewise, since I have got yourselves so close as you are," answered Conall, who had followed their lead in this action. Then he went and he began upon them. "I feared to be chasing you from hole to hole, and from hill to hill, and I did that." Then he gazed at them, from one to two, and he seized on the one of the slenderest shanks and the fattest head, he drove upon the rest slacked, till he had killed every one of them, and he had not a jot of the one with whom he was working at them, but what was in his hands of the shanks. The tale of Conall Gulban, recorded by Campbell of Isla, continues with many wonderful fights in other lands. In France, for example, Conall wins in the same absurd way over the house of the Tamhéisg, the best warriors that the King of France had. MacRitchie concluded, "It is of course to be understood that the passage as it stands is as impossible as it is ludicrous. But this docs not interfere with their assumption that the basis of the story actual encounter between men of tall stature and race of dwarfs, the excessive number of the latter, and the case, willy which the hero swings them about, being merely the embroidering of Talclelks in later times. As for the seeming impossibility that Atfil could be transmitted for 15 centuries and yet be historical, MacRitchie adds, it ought to be remembered that the oral transmission of history and genealogy, with the most careful attention in language and details, was a perfect science among the Gaelic-speaking peoples. But, then, what became of the dwarfish race? According to MacRitchie, the dwarfs were destroyed or went into hiding toward the 6th century, when Columba and his followers carried on a religious war against the Picts. At the same time, he says, the Irishmen were also using force against the same people in the north of Ireland. And since the new owners of the land felt for their ancient enemies a mixture of guilt and fear, numerous rumors were born concerning the ghosts of the Picts, still roaming through the land. and this in turn led to the elves and fairies. This theory, generally referred to as the pygmy theory, is, however, now no longer tenable in the face of the evidences Taurians have gathered about the Picts. The name Picti, according to Wainwright, appears first in 297 AD, and from that time on, it is applied to all the peoples who lived north of the Antonine Wall and were not Scots. In earlier times, we are really concerned with the predecessors of the Picts, who formed various groups called Proto-Picts. Could Macritchie's pygmies have figured among the Proto-Picts? Wainwright gives the following translation of a passage from the historic Lorwegi already referred to above. These islands were first inhabited by the Picts and the Pipi. Of these, one race, the Picts, little exceeded pygmies in stature. They did marvels, in the morning and in the evening, in building walled towns, but at midday they entirely lost all their strength, and lurked through fear in little underground houses. And Wainwright comments, the story is interesting in that it brings together Picts, Souterrains, and perhaps Brocks, at once explaining the common belief that their Picts were a pygmy people and providing an early example of the mistaken equations implicit in the names Picts houses, Souterrains, and Pictish towers, Brocks. Should we believe that, among the Proto-Picts, there were dwarfs who were mistaken for a native people? And, then, where did they come from? Macritchie's theory offers only confusion, and it is amusing to observe his embarrassment when he must report that the Fenlanders were not only dwarfish, but black, too. Could it be that there were Icles in Northern Europe at the dawn of recorded history? I believe we have at least established that there were open questions in the minds of the scholars of all epochs concerning such beings, and on this point Icle and Docs not disagree with Macritchie. Nothing is more likely than the transfer to the mythical beings of Celtic superstition of some features derived from alien races. In his conclusion to his discussion of the pygmy theory, which he rejects as Hartland does, Wentz remarks that it leaves all the problems of the historical origins of the fairy faith unsolved, since it is clearly global, not limited to the Celtic lands. Thus A. Lang, in his introduction to the 1922 edition of Kirk's book, states that to my mind at least, the subterranean inhabitants of Mr. Kirk's book are not so much a traditional recollection of a real dwarfish race living underground, a hypothesis of Sir Walter Scott's, as a lingering memory of the Chthonian beings, the ancestors. Folklore in the making. No matter how interesting it may be to speculate on the origin of these ancient beliefs, the opportunity to observe folklore in the making is even more attractive to those with an inclination toward research. When modern rumors appear to fall into the very same patterns that have puzzled generations of scientists, theologians, and literary scholars, the feeling one gets is a mixture of gratitude and enthusiasm. When the phone rings in Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and a local intelligence officer transmits the observation of a motorist who has just been buzzed by what he describes as a flying saucer, we are really witnessing the unique conjunction of the modern world, with its technology, and ancient terrors, with all the power of their sudden, fugitive, irrational nature. We are in a very privileged position. Neither Wentz nor Hartland was able to interview people who had just observed the phenomena they studied. Most of their witnesses spoke of days gone by, of stories heard by the fireplace. We feel, on the other hand, that we can almost reach out into the night and grab those lurking entities. We are hot on their trail, the air is still vibrating with excitement, the smell of sulfur is still there when the story is recorded. Take, for instance, the story of the Air Force colonel who was driving at night on a lonely Illinois road when he noticed that a strange object was flying above his car. It looked, he said, like a bird, but it was the size of a small airplane. It flapped its wings and flew away. This is the type of horror story adolescent girls sometimes tell their mothers when they come home late and a bit nervous. But an Air Force colonel? During November-December, 1966. West Virginia was plagued by a similar bird, called the Mothman by imaginative reporters. One witness, 25-year-old Thomas A., who lives in Clarksburg, met the creature at 7:15 a.m. on November 25, 1966, in the vicinity of Point Pleasant. It was a large gray thing which rose from a nearby field. It came up like a helicopter and veered over my car, he told John Keel, who spent many days in the area investigating the reports. He accelerated up to 75 miles per hour, but the bird was still there, casually circling the car. It appeared to be about 6 feet long, with a wingspread of 8 to 10 feet. According to other witnesses quoted by Keel, the figure had large, round, glowing red eyes. On January 11, 1967, Mrs. McDaniel saw the bird herself in broad daylight. She was outside her home when she observed what appeared to be a small plane flying down the road almost at treetop level. As it drew closer, she realized it was a man-shaped object with wings. It swooped low over her head and circled a nearby restaurant before going out of sight. Mrs. McDaniel, who works in the Point Pleasant Unemployment Office, is known in the community as a rational and responsible person. 79 Now consider this report. The intruder was tall, thin and powerful. He had a prominent nose, and bony fingers of immense power which resembled claws. He was incredibly agile. He wore a long, flowing cloak, of the sort affected by opera goers, soldiers and strolling actors. On his head was a tall, metallic-seeming helmet. Beneath the cloak were close-fitting garments of some glittering material like oilskin or metal mesh. There was a lamp strapped to his chest. Oddest of all, the creature's ears were cropped or pointed like those of an animal. Was it a prankster in a Batman dress? It seems entirely possible. Especially when we take into account the fact that the bird was carrying something on its back and made incredible leaps, actually flying, on one occasion, above the heads of would-be captors. There is only one trouble with this explanation. The latter episode took place not in West Virginia in 1966 but in the dark lanes of a London suburb, in November, 1837. Like the Mothman of Point Pleasant, the mysterious flying man of London was ignored by authorities as long as possible. Finally, a resident of Peckham wrote a letter to the Lord Mayor, and the censorship could no longer be maintained. Nightly, horse patrols searched the countryside. Admiral Codrington set up a reward fund, still unclaimed, by the way. And J. Vink, in a remarkable article about the mystery, informs us that even the old Duke of Wellington himself set holsters at his saddle bow and rode out after dark in search of Spring-Eel Jack. On February 20, 1838, a girl of 18, Jane Allsop, of Old Ford, near Bow, London, heard a violent ringing of the front door bell. Going out, she faced the most hideous appearance of Spring-Eel Jack. He wore shining garments and a flashing lamp on his chest. His eyes resembled glowing balls of fire. When Miss Allsop uttered a cry, the intruder grabbed her arm in claw-like fingers, but the girl's sister rushed to her rescue. The visitor spurted a fiery gas in Jane's face, and she dropped unconscious. Then Jack fled, dropping his cloak, which was picked up at once by another shadow who ran after him. 2 days earlier, though not revealed until after the Old Ford incident had made headlines, a Miss Scales, of Limehouse, was walking through Green Dragon Alley. The alley was a dimlit passage beside a public house, and when she saw a tall figure lurking in the shadows, Miss Scales hesitated, waiting for her sister who had fallen behind. The sister, who described the loiterer as tall, thin and, say the mark, gentlemanly, came up in time to see his long cloak thrown aside, and a lantern flashing on the startled girl. There was no time to scream. Jack's weird blue flame spurted into his victim's face and she dropped to the ground in a deep swoon. Whereupon, Jack walked away calmly. Viner suggests that Jack had a rendezvous in Green Dragon Alley and wanted to get rid of witnesses. A week after the Old Ford incident, he knocked on the door of Miss Trashworth's house in Turner Street and inquired for him. The servant who opened the door screamed the place down. Jack fled. He was never seen again, in the London neighborhood at least. Had a contact been made? It is strange indeed, as Viner remarks, that Springfield Jack should have paid two visits within 2 days to houses less than a mile apart, whose owners were named Alsop and Ashworth, respectively. Two of the main witnesses, as in West Virginia, were young girls. With them, in the two cases, were their sisters. There seems to be a pattern here. But, rather typically, it is once again an absurd one. In 1877, wearing tight garments and shining helmet, Jack was seen again at Aldershot, Hampshire, England. On that occasion he flew above two sentries, who fired at him. He answered with a burst of blue fire, which left them stunned, and vanished. Viner believes that Jack was again to blame for the scare in late August, 1944, in Mattoon, Illinois. He was seen at night peering through windows as in search for someone known to him by sight. Most of the witnesses were women. Some of them reported falling unconscious after a device was pointed at them by the visitor, who left a strange cloying smell. In the spring of 1960, Italian jeweler Salvatore Chonsi was driving in Sicily, near Syracuse, when a small being in shining clothes wearing a diving helmet appeared in the beam of the headlights. It had no arms but two little wings. Mr. Chonsi suffered a nervous shock. On Saturday, November 16, 1963, four teenagers were walking near Sandling Park, near Hythe, Kent, England. One of the four, 17-year-old John Flaxton, describes how they were frightened by an object which they first had taken to be a star. It was uncanny. The reddish-yellow light was coming out of the sky at an angle of 60 degrees. As it came towards the ground it seemed to hover more slowly. A bright light, golden in color, suddenly appeared in the field near them after the first object had been hidden by some trees. It was about 80 yards away, floating about 10 feet above the ground. It seemed to move along with us, stopping when we stopped as if it was observing us. The light was oval, about 15 to 20 feet across with a bright, solid core. It disappeared behind trees and a few seconds later a dark figure shambled out. It was all black, about the size of a human but without a head. It seemed to have wings like a bat on either side and came stumbling towards us. We didn't wait to investigate, folklore in the making. From the far faddits, we have drifted to modern times, with Springfield Jack and the Mothman. And we have seen our visitors' arsenal become more precise. Jack's lantern and ray gun have survived in modern tales, in 20th century comic books, in television series. But the real question is, could all this be real? And if not, how can we explain the consistency of these descriptions, at a time when there were no comics and no television? The Italian artist R.L. Joannes had a remarkable experience in 1947, at a time when the name Flying Saucer was already popular in the United States. But when the now abundant documentation about the landings was non-existent. The date was, as he recalls, August 14. He was hiking alone, following a small stream in the mountainous region between Italy and Yugoslavia. Among some rocks, he suddenly saw a large, brilliant red, lens-shaped object, about 10 yards in diameter. Close to it, he discovered two people, whom he first regarded as kids until he realized they were dwarfs, of a type he had never seen before. The two beings were under 3 feet tall, their heads were larger than a man's head. They had no hair, eyelashes, or eyebrows. Their faces were greenish, their noses straight, their mouths wide slits, giving them something of the appearance of a fish. Their eyes were huge, round, and prominent, their color, yellow-green. The skin around their eyes formed rings rather than eyelids. As Joannes moved, one of the beings touched his belt. At once, from the center of the belt something like a ray and a puff of vapor were emitted. Joannes experienced something like an electrical discharge and found himself on the ground, helpless and very weak. It took all his energy to turn his head around and observed the two beings as they walked away. A moment later they were gone. In 1965 a case very similar to Joannes's was reported to the US Air Force, and we tried in vain to get an active investigation of it by Project Blue Book. Finally the case was leaked, at my suggestion, to a civilian group, which conducted a speedy and careful study of the testimony given by the only witness, a Mr. S. The details of the testimony are available in an excellent book by the leaders of the civilian group, the Lorenzans. Also, I need not discuss all the circumstances of the observation. Some remarks concerning the case, called by the Lorenzans the most spectacular report we have examined, are relevant in the present context, however. The incident took place on September 4, 1964, in the mountains of Northern California, about 8 miles from Cisco Grove. Mr. S. had been hunting when he became separated from the party and lost his way. Night was falling, so he lighted some fires to call attention to his position. Soon Lai observed a light in the sky, which he thought was a helicopter looking for him. When it stopped and hovered silently nearby, however, he realized it was an unusual object and climbed a large tree to observe the situation from that vantage point. The light circled the tree. S. saw a flash and a dark object falling to the ground. Next he noticed one figure crashing through the woods below him and another moving in from a slightly different direction. Both figures approached the tree and looked at him. They were a little over 5 feet tall, the witness estimates, and clothed in a silvery uniform that covered their heads. A third creature appeared later, behaving more like a mechanical being than an animal or a man. It was darker and had two reddish-orange eyes. It had no mouth, but rather a slit-like opening that would drop open like an oven door. For the rest of the time S. was conscious. The entities used a variety of means to try to get him to fall from his tree. He managed to keep them away by throwing lighted bits of paper and clothing at them, to which they reacted in fear. The main weapon used against him was a very curious one. If we are to believe this report, the robot-like entity would let its lower jaw drop, then place its hand inside the rectangular cavity thus revealed, and emit a puff of smoke in S.S. direction. The smoke would spread like a mist, and upon reaching him, it would make him lose consciousness for a certain time. The effect of it was comparable to being suddenly deprived of oxygen, S. said. It is hard to believe the story. Would not such beings as he describes be able to climb a tree? If they came out of a flying saucer, why could they not fly up to his refuge? But it is equally difficult to prove that he simply had a nightmare. The witness is not given to such behavior, and when he woke up at dawn, still tied to the tree with his belt, all the objects he had dropped in an effort to get rid of the intruders were still lying around. Furthermore, there is the description of the strange, powerful gas, which plays such an important role in the story, as it does in the incidents related to Springheel Jack, the Joannis sighting, and the Sunnydays Vigers case of August, 1952. According to Captain Ruppelt's report of his investigations in Florida, 32 Des Vigers, a scoutmaster who went into a wood to investigate a strange light and faced, he said, a horrible being who looked at him from the turret of a flying machine unlike anything he had ever seen, found himself breathing the same peculiar gas. He froze where he stood and noticed a small ball of red fire began to drift toward him. As it floated down, it expanded into a cloud of red mist. He dropped his light and machete, and put his arms over his face. As the mist enveloped him, Lai passed out. This is confirmed by the unpublished memorandum written by Ruppelt on September 12, 1952, upon his return from West Palm Beach. Captain Ruppelt and Lieutenant R.M. Olson began their investigation by a conference with Captain Corney, Wing Intel Eigensesser with the 1,707th Air Base Wing, on the morning of September 9. A conference was held with Captain Corney to determine whether or not there had been any late developments in this case that the two ATIC officers were not familiar with. Captain Corney stated that to his knowledge there was nothing outstanding that had happened. He was asked about the facts of supposedly anonymous threatening telephone calls that Mr. Desvigers had received. He stated that Desvigers had called him approximately 2 weeks ago and stated that he had been receiving anonymous threatening telephone calls while at work in the establishment in which he is employed. The gist of the calls was telling Desvigers to lay off of his story and that if he didn't he would be sorry and several other things. Not much attention was given to this claim, however, and Rupkelt continued his investigations by interviewing people who knew the Scoutmaster, and especially the members of the scout group who were with him in the car when he decided to go into the woods. He gave the boys instructions to go get help if he wasn't back in 10 minutes and started in the woods. The boys claimed that they could see his flashlight going back into the woods. From this point on, the boys' stories varied to a certain degree. The first boy states that he did not seconds the first light that Desvigers saw, however, shortly afterwards, after Desvigers had got out, made the statement about flying saucers, and got back into the automobile, he looked out of the window and saw a semicircle of white lights about 3 inches in diameter, thick, going down at an angle of 45 degrees into the trees. None of the other Boy Scouts saw this. He then states that he saw Desvigers go back into the woods and that the next thing that he saw was a series of red lights in the clearing. As soon as he saw the red lights, he claims that he saw Sunny stiffen up and fall. According to two other boys, they both saw Desvigers going through the woods, could seconds flashlights flashing on the trees and then he disappeared for a few seconds, at least the light disappeared. The next thing they saw was a series of red lights. They said they looked a lot like flares or sky rockets. The lights were not making any definite pattern, some of them were going up, some of them were going down, or going around and around in all directions. It just seemed to be a type of 6 or 8 red lights going in all directions. This time they ran down the road to get help. Here we have confirmation from witnesses of the observation of red lights. The witnesses were not close enough, however, to experience the lights' effects, but it is interesting to remark that the lights kept going around and around after the Scoutmaster, according to his own account of the incident, was already unconscious. It is also interesting to note, in this connection, that over a century ago Rudy C. Lingsey, in his Lever Day Legends, had this to say about the elves: if a mortal being dares come near them, they open their mouth and, struck by the breath which escapes from it, the imprudent fellow dies poisoned. On October 7, 1954, Mr. Margaillan saw an object which had landed in a field in Montcux, France. It was shaped like a hemisphere, about 2.5 yards in diameter. The witness gasped for air and felt paralyzed during the observation. The sudden lack of air noted in the Cisco Grove case is not infrequently reported by witnesses of landings. Nor are the peculiar eyes of the small entities, reddish-orange, glowing in the dark. On October 9, 1954, in Laves, Vienne, France, a farmer who was riding his bicycle suddenly stopped as he saw a figure, dressed in a sort of diving suit, aiming a double light beam at him. The individual, who seemed to have boots without heels, very bright eyes, and a very hairy chest, carried 2 headlights, one below the other, on the front of his suit. 9 days later, in Fontenay-Torcy, also in France, a man and his wife reported that they saw a red cigar-shaped object in the sky. All of a sudden, it dived toward them, leaving a reddish trail, and landed behind some bushes. Upon reaching the top of a hill, the witnesses found themselves confronted by a bulky individual, human in appearance but only about 3 feet tall. He wore a helmet, and his eyes glowed with an orange light. One of the witnesses lost consciousness. 4 other people saw the object in flight from another spot. A third group of independent witnesses in another town, Saint-Sauve-la-Pitrie-7, saw the craft fly away at tremendous speed, in a westerly direction. The countryside was illuminated over an area 1 to 2 miles wide. It is indeed appropriate to tell the man who investigates such cases in the words of Robert Herrick, "Her eyes the glow-worm lend thee, the shooting stars attend thee, and the elves also, whose little eyes glow like the sparks of fire, befriend thee, to Magonia and back." The mind of a person coming out of fairyland is usually blank as to what has been seen and done there. Walter Wentz, The Fairy Faith in Celtic Countries. The mind of Private First Class Jerry Irwin was blank when he woke up on March 2, 1959, in Cedar City Hospital. He had been unconscious for 23 hours, at times mumbling incoherently something about a jacket on the bush. When he became conscious, his first question was, were there any survivors? The story of Private Irwin is a mysterious one, and very little has been done to clarify it.